Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you listen to The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites here on WEAA 88.9 FM, celebrating 88 days of summer. More details at WEAA.org. And, of course, Soundbites is also heard on Delmarva Public Radio. And reminding you, The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is how to make its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com. We begin our show with a story we were talked to us about months back. One of my former producers, the great hardworking Justin Levy, who's off now learning how to do film and being a film producer and editor, told me about this guy who's listened to our show for a long time named Dan Jensen, who all of a sudden made this gigantic kind of hit across the globe because it came out that he ate literally nothing but pizza. Pizza was his life. And so it became this huge thing. And he couldn't come on back then. In fact, he got so sick of media, he just wanted to run away and eat pizza and not be bothered. But Justin Levy produced this movie called Pizza King, the Vice Munchies documentary of Jensen called Pizza King. And Justin, our former producer, produced this great little movie. And Dan Jensen's in the studio, who's been eating pizza every day for the past 25 years. And you can find his work at iampremiumwood.org.
Imperial Wood.
He's a great woodworker, and that's his business when he's not eating pizza. So welcome both. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Justin, how are you?
I'm great, Mark. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Good to have you here. 410-319-8888 is the number. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. 410-319-8888. Before we turn to Dan, set this up for us, Justin, and how this began. With the world taking notice of this and then led to this movie you made?
Sure. Well, back in February of this year, I was pitching some articles to Vice, and I hadn't written for them yet, and I had a few different ideas that I was talking with an editor there about. And in the course of that time, I was on the phone with Dan one night, who's one of my best friends. We've been close friends for over 15 years, and I was telling him, like, I was in the process of coming up with some ideas for, like, food-related articles and interviews that I was going to possibly write, and just as a joke, we started talking about, you know, oh, like, we should do something together, because your diet is so crazy. You know, like, everybody that knows Dan knows that he eats basically only pizza and very few other foods, and, you know, has a diet like unlike anybody else anyone will probably ever know. So Dan was like, oh yeah, that'd be funny, and, like, you know, I was like, yeah, I'm gonna do it. And then I almost didn't do it because it just seemed so ridiculous. You know, like, who else would want to read about my weird friend? But I kind of tacked on that idea along with what I thought were some more, like, substantial, serious sorts of pitches. And the editor was like, you know, hey, like, why don't you try this pizza thing? You know, like, let's go ahead and do that. And I said, yeah, sure, if you want. You know, I could do that in no time. All you need to do is call Dan anytime.
And it went viral.
Yeah. So they posted it. It went viral immediately. News media around the world picked up the story. Everybody kind of recycled it. It was so, everywhere. Like,
so then how did that feel? All of a sudden you were this friend of Justin Levy's, and he wrote this piece about you, and you became this world-famous pizza eater.
Exactly. When he first – and I admit it, I'm a freak of nature. You know, my diet, I would not recommend to anyone. But it just goes to show that people love pizza. The story really struck a chord with people. Some people were very angry. Some people were like, right on, keep going. But it struck a chord with everyone, and I was not prepared for that. I went to bed. Justin told me the article was coming out online. I went to bed thinking, oh, you know, a few thousand people will see it. My parents will never see it. Maybe my close friends will see it. I was familiar with Vice.com, but I didn't quite know how big it was. I was sort of a younger audience than I am. And I woke up to 5 in the morning. I had radio stations from around the country calling me. my inbox was 5 pages deep. And this was after the first evening that the article broke.
But let's play a little clip from the film so you get a sense of what this is about, what he's about, and what this film is about.
I'm famous now for eating pizza. When we were first talking about doing the article, Man Survives on Pizza for 25 Years, I thought maybe a few thousand people would see it. That's what I thought was going to happen. And the exact opposite happened. The world now knows that I'm the guy who eats pizza. There's a lot of guys, a lot of women out there, too. Say, I'd love to do that every day. I mean, Kelly Ripa is like, I'd love to do that every day. If I could, you can.
I don't like vegetables. Why would I eat a pizza with mushrooms on it when I really like a standard cheese pizza? I don't want to sort of corrupt the taste.
That got me in the mood that cracked me up the most, Dan, about your pizza thing is that, you know, with this show we talk about healthy diets sometimes and eating organic foods and all the stuff that your girlfriend, now wife, would like you to do.
Yes.
Because you just got married over the weekend.
Yes, I did.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
But you just want your pizza full of tomato sauce and cheese and extra tomato sauce.
Yep.
Forget the vegetables. Don't put broccoli on my pizza.
No.
None of that.
I like extra sauce, well done. Any of the local pizza shops around my area know when I call up, extra sauce, well done. That's the way I like it. To me, if it has a few vegetables on it, it's still a pizza. But if it's a veggie lover's or a meat lover's or whatever, it's not a pizza at that point. It's just a bunch of vegetables with some sauce under it.
So you've been doing this 25 years. So how many times a day do you eat pizza?
Well, some days it's all I eat. Some days I'll eat. And on those days, maybe I'll have two meals and I'll eat it for breakfast. I'll run around, come home, finish the pizza, and then I'm done. But I don't do that every day. And in the documentary, that was sort of a misconception. The article said, man survives on pizza 3 meals a day. I think the Vice editors sort of, you know, sensationalized that a little bit. I do eat other things. And in the documentary, it starts off with me saying, I do eat other things. I don't eat 3 meals every single day. But people always skip over that part. So I eat a lot of pizza. I eat it every single day. Sometimes I'll only eat it, but I also have a few other things in there.
So Justin, I mean, in producing this, I was thinking about you because as you made this film of your friend, because in the years you worked with me, and you and Cricket were my producers at that time, you were both vegans then.
Yes.
So you have my vegan producers doing a movie about pizza. Because I remember one time we went out to do a taping, we went to get pizza, and the two of you got pizza with no cheese on it.
Yeah, see, that's the great thing about pizza is that it's very adaptable to lots of different diets. Vegan pizza can be great. You know, you can, like, Dan wouldn't like it. One of the pizzas actually that we're eating in the film was a vegan pizza at Joe Squared in Baltimore. And it had vegan cheese and it had all different vegetables, and Dan like looked at it and discussed. There's, you know, one of the shots is in there. I have to say that in the course of shooting the film, I pretty much ate nothing but pizza for a few days with Dan. Sometimes one day I think I had pizza 4 meals, not even just 3. And got into some non-vegan pizzas, so my diet's been stretched a little bit.
So what did you eat for breakfast this morning, Dan?
Actually, I didn't have breakfast this
morning. You didn't have
it. But now that I'm in the city, I'm going to go get pizza after this.
You should.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know where you're going to go for pizza?
Actually, I have to go to Hamden after this. I might stop by Art House. So if they're open, they might not be open. If they're not open, I'll go to Joe Squared.
So did you have pizza on your honeymoon night?
Let's see. We haven't gone on our honeymoon yet. We're going in January when it's cold here. Uh-huh. We're going to go someplace warm. But we did go to Harper's Ferry for a couple days. And I went to the Epic Buffet at the casino in Charlestown. And I had pizza.
So now you're going to plan your honeymoon and other trips on whether or not pizza exists in these places?
Well, my wife, it's weird to say that, my wife wants to go to Japan, and we were talking about it last night, and I said, no way. Everything there, even their vegetarian food there, has fish in it, and I bet their pizza's awful. So no offense, but, you know, they're not known for pizza, so we're not going there.
Well, this has been
– Mark.
Yeah.
I can send you a picture if you want to post of I was at Dan and Madeline's wedding on Saturday, and while everybody else was served their vegetarian or non-vegetarian entrees, Dan was served a pizza.
It's true.
So, Justin, how can people see this video of yours?
It is on the Munchies website, which is Vice's food-related coverage. The easiest thing to do is just Google Pizza King Vice, and it'll pop right up.
And we'll have that on our website. Watched it again late last night just to kind of see it again. It was a great little film. I think you did a great job with this film, Justin.
Thank you so much.
You definitely have a career beyond radio.
I appreciate it.
It's really good. Really good. Check out Justin Levy's video and Dan Jensen. Also go to Dan Jensen's website.
Imperium Wood. Imperium Wood.
ImperiumWood.org, and he makes these incredible handles for razors. And you also have this incredible handle. We got to go now, but I just meant to say this before we go. When you did the thing, one thing I wrote to Justin was, "I want to know about the gear shift handle in your car."
Oh yeah,
what is that, man? It was way up, almost above your head.
It's sort of in the tradition, just real quick, about the old hot rod style, right, where they'd have the shifters way up high.
Right.
So it's a throwback to that. Now it's in a truck, and I can't go very fast, but I turned the handle out of a rosewood, and then I just stuck it on a long pipe.
I love that. I love that handle. That I liked. That really got to me.
Thank you.
I got to come see this handle in your truck.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to check this out. So, Dan Jensen, thank you very much for being coming in the studio.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to meet you.
And I-A-M-P-E-R-I-U-M-Wood.
I-M-P-E-R-I-U-M-W-O-O-D. Imperium Wood.
Yeah. Check that out and check his new workout. He's launching this whole new career. And Justin Levy will go link to Pizza Man. Thank you so much, Justin. And
thanks, Mark. I appreciate it.
We're going to a brief break. We're going to come back with Tim Wheeler and look at what's up with phosphorus and why can't we control it. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Mark Steiner. You're listening to Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites. And once again, it's time to talk to Tim Wheeler, reporter for Be More Green, the Baltimore Sun's environmental blog, which is getting a lot of play in the newspaper, as it should. He does a lot of great reporting. Tim, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hi, Mark. Sorry, a little technical difficulty there this morning, but we're on now.
We're here. That's fine. Good. We're here. So there was an interesting editorial in the Sun. Our view, recent studies suggest poultry industry is to blame for rising Chesapeake Bay pollution problem. Your regulations to address to remain on hold, as he's campaigning as kind of the environmental presidential candidate or faux candidate or not running just officially yet. So talk a bit about what the issue is here. Why, after there was kind of a way to figure out how to manage and measure the amount of phosphorus running on farms, it stopped. And where are we? I mean, it seems pretty absurd.
Well, we're in a little bit of a waiting pattern right now, as we've been reporting since, I guess since last year and even before. The state has been promising for a few years now to actually take a closer look at how much phosphorus is going on farm fields throughout the state. It's primarily a problem on the lower eastern shore where poultry litter, animal manure is widely used as a fertilizer. It's great source of nitrogen for corn and soybeans and the other crops that are grown down there. But the problem is that those crops can't use up all the phosphorus that's in that manure, and it tends to build up in the soil. And if it reaches a certain point, it basically just runs off into nearby streams and rivers in the bay. And so the state has said they would do something about this to change it. They drew up a regulation, what was called the Phosphorus Management Tool. They consulted scientists, agricultural scientists, and water quality scientists to try to, you know, to fine-tune this regulation so that there would be less of this over-application of phosphorus to the soils. And the problem is that the farming community is very nervous about any change in the status quo. This manure is, as I said, widely used as a fertilizer. It means they don't have to go out and buy chemical fertilizer for their crops. And so they're concerned about that, and the growers are concerned that if they don't have this other, you know, this option to you know, spread the stuff as fertilizer, then what are they going to do with it all? So they've you know, raised concerns. The State Department of Agriculture twice, maybe even really three times, opposed this regulation, pulled it back for further review after objections from the farm community, and then just this past winter they announced they were going to, you know, take some more time to study it. They were looking to phase it in. The legislature sort of helped them along by essentially directing them to conduct a study of the economic impact of these regulations, and that study is ongoing right now. It's supposed to wrap up by fall, and the state says they are still planning. State Agriculture Secretary told me not long ago he's still planning to repropose these regulations in the fall for imposition by the end of the year.
I think maybe I misheard you, but it sounded like you said poultry secretary, not ag secretary.
Agriculture secretary. Yeah. Did I call him?
But you did. You did.
All right. But, my apologies.
I think
the secretary of all agriculture, not just the poultry. Yeah.
But I think in some ways that kind of begs the question that was even raised in the editorial about the governor's ties to the poultry industry and just. Kind of, even though we're talking about the fate of the Bay, and he's chairman of the Chesapeake the commission that's supposed to kind of come up with interstate regulations, that the ties are so deep to the industry, it seems to be hard to get anything done.
Well, it you certainly have to ask him about you know how he balances or juggles that. You know, he has been very supportive of the of agriculture, of the poultry industry. At the same time, these regulations, you know, upset them. And he has, you know, he has publicly stated that, you know, he's committed to cleaning up the bay, and he's chided them for at least the Delmarva poultry industry, the industry trade group has chided their director for some of the opposition to these regulations in the past. So it's a there's a little bit of tension there, but you know there are concerns about whether this will actually happen on his watch, and there certainly has been some pressure from the agriculture community to delay this, you know, either to delay the regulations and perhaps even to delay the completion of this economic impact study, you know, to further study it for another 2 years or 3 years. It has been suggested in the agriculture community they wouldn't be unhappy if this was put off until 2017, when the entire Bay restoration effort comes under a sort of a midpoint review.
So, and you've also been writing about this this highly touted, some people say highly touted, chicken manure to energy facility that cannot get off the ground on the Eastern Shore, and that the state was going to put even more money in to try to make it happen.
Well, yeah, it's also a little bit in flux right now. The state, you know, for years, again, this was an O'Malley administration initiative, dates back to 2011, maybe even a little before that. A number of people have proposed, you know, the one thing that would help is if there were other alternatives for chicken manure for poultry litter. And one proposal that keeps coming back was, well, why not, you know, burn it for energy? It's done in other places. So there are facilities in Europe that generate power using poultry litter and animal manure. There are a few in this country, not as many. The state put out a call for proposals, got some in 2012, and then in 2013, January, they signed a contract pledged to buy power from a California company that was proposing to build on an eastern shore. It's had some trouble finding a site and getting started, however. When I talked to them just recently, they said they were close to getting a new site, but we're still waiting to hear about that, and the clock is ticking. The contract permits the company to start supplying power by the end of 2016, and the state has said that they are, state energy administrator said that they're actually looking at possibly sweetening the deal by offering to pay even more for the power than they originally agreed to in order to try to make it perhaps a bit easier for them to find financing.
Aren't there some opposition to this manure factory as well? I mean, the idea of going to energy. One of the things, the debates we had on here was somebody was saying that there are questions about the kind of pollution that is involved in creating this energy from chicken manure to energy. I mean, what about that piece of the controversy?
Sure. Well, anytime you burn something, you always got to ask yourself, what are going to be the effects on air quality? The company says they're going to use best available control technology, but that's always a question of what is best and what does it cost and how effective is it going to be. There are at least a couple of different processes for how to do this. They're proposing to essentially do a boiler operation to process the litter and then burn it. There are others who have a small plant in Pennsylvania that actually essentially extracts organic gas, methane, and whatnot from the manure and burns that, which they argue is a sort of a cleaner alternative. But the air quality from the emissions. There's also the issue of collecting and storing all that poultry litter. How you would keep the odors down and make this a good neighbor. So those are all issues to be dealt with here.
So I just a funny tweet just came in. Delegate Shane Robinson just from Montgomery County just tweeted in. Hashtag a poultry secretary works too. So, and also then tweeted in, burning manure for energy is not green or renewable. It merely entrenches a broken ag system hashtag greenwashing. And so there's controversy around all these things. I mean, I know there are a lot of environmental groups and others that are actually for it. But there is some give and take here in terms of what this facility would and would not do.
Sure. There is not unanimity among the environmental groups on this. There's some who are dead set against it, others who think it is, a potential way to deal with this problem and not, without it, you've got a major issue here. There's really, a basic problem is you're bringing in nutrients to feed to these chickens, to these birds, in a place where there's not enough suitable places to use all those nutrients. So you have to get them out of here one way or the other. The state is spending taxpayer money and some industry money to actually haul the stuff by truck around the bay into other parts of the watershed where the soils aren't saturated with phosphorus. And there's been an effort by Purdue over the years to convert some of the poultry litter into dry pellets that are easier to store, and then they've sold those to for use as soil amendment fertilizer outside of the Chesapeake Bay watershed, but not enough by far. And in the process, the company says they've lost lots of money, $50 million over the years by their account. There's sort of a public investment in this here, and one has to ask whether the the industry itself is fully paying the price, and whether the public is fully paying the price for what we're getting here.
Well, we'll be doing a much more extensive conversation on this particular issue in our next soundbites next week, and we'll be looking at this kind of in a much more greater depth with all sides on talking about the future of this. And so, Tim Wheeler, a reporter for Be More Green, the Baltimore Sun's environmental blog, always good to read what you write, and always good to have you on the air with us.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you so much. This month, I moderated another Good Food Gathering town hall meeting. This time at the Netzavot Shalom congregation in Pikesville, we discussed acting well and explored how congregations and individuals can affect systemic change in our food system. We talked with Dr. Serena Jordan, who conducts wellness classes at Huma Memorial Church, author of the book The Seven Disciplines of Wellness, Appy Zuckerberg, who organized a faith garden and compost project at Netzavot Shalom congregation, Robbie Rawl, who is executive director of Sugar Free Kids, an organization that encourages congregations to engage in political actions that improve the health of children, and Michael J. Wilson, who is executive director of Maryland Hunger Solutions. This town hall meeting was sponsored by the Baltimore Food and Faith Project, part of the Center for a Livable Future, Interfaith Power and Light, and the Mark Steiner Show. And last week, we listened to the first part of the conversation. Today, we hear the audience question and answer portion of that evening, and we jump back into the middle of that conversation about how hard it is as a parent to keep your kids away from sugar. I have three daughters, four grandchildren, and I didn't have a very easy time, nor did I really deny them sugar. It was there. Candy, sweets, cake, sodas, you know, and it was part of the life of the house. It's not something you can, it's not easy to separate you and your children away from the larger mass, from less people, what they want, and how you change that is very difficult. I mean, I'm the last person to be a holier than thou about that, because I mean, as much as I try, you know, I can't. But you want to say something about that, I can tell.
So what I'd like to say, and kind of work my way backwards immediately, I was a single parent at one time, so I've lived the struggle, had been on food stamps and all of that, public assistance. When I got married, we decided that we were going to homeschool our children, so we became stay-at-home mom, still working on one income. During that time, I participated in WIC and things like that, but I gained knowledge as I went along. So now I'm a nutrition educator. So to answer the question, what do? It's small changes a little at a time. And as I learned information, I began to include it into my own house. So there was a time where you could come into my freezer and there were 3 half-gallons when half-gallons were really half-gallons of ice cream, okay, really, on any given day. And so I began to take that out because they were eating it too fast, and I substituted that with yogurt. Began to put fruit out on the table. So you kept saying something about choice. It's about giving them choices, but it's either do you want an apple or do you want an orange? Not do you want candy or do you want fruit? You know, do you want, we were the 99-cent, 3-liter gallon of soda. Okay, that used to be my household. Now, just over time, there's usually only juice. We've gotten down to 1% milk now in my house. So it's baby steps. It's little steps. And at one point, my children did not like me. I was not. When we started making these strategies, like reducing the amount of meat that we eat in the house. And we adopted, even though my children were homeschooled, we still adopted the Baltimore City policy when Tony Garaci was here on Meatless Mondays. Right. And so we incorporated that into our own house, Meatless Monday. We still hold that true to this day. So it's just making small changes and giving them choice, but you give them two healthy choices, not a unhealthy choice and a healthy choice.
How many years did it take you to do that with your kids?
She's still doing it.
Yeah, that's right. It is. Yeah. It's an evolving process.
Still evolving.
It is. And so my son's middle school had a farm there. And so he was very involved in that. And so he came home one day and said, Mom, I want to grow vegetables at home. So someone was throwing out some bookcases that we live in a row house in Baltimore City. Yes, we have rats, but we do that. We took those bookcases, which made great raised beds. And last year, my son and I planted vegetables in our own backyard. And we're doing it again this year. So I'm just here to say it can be done. One last point, because I don't want to forget the faith-based movement. As a nutrition educator, I approached my spiritual leader and asked her if I would be able to do a health tip. So for the last 5 years, every Sunday that I'm there, I get about a minute or two just to share one small health tip with our congregation. I have a 14-year-old girl who's now 17. She's become a vegetarian.
On her own.
On her own, just by, you know, taking in the information. And people have been talking about changes in their diet and, you know, the less of pain and losing weight and things. So, and we have a garden. It's on hiatus, but we get ready to start tomorrow and redo our garden at church again. So I'm just here to encourage. It can be done. Small changes at a time. Whatever opportunity avails itself to you, take advantage and spread the message. It works.
What's your name?
Monica.
Monica, thank you.
Thank you.
I mean, I think that's really was an important, what we all three people just finished saying, because we have this idea that things have to come in this gigantic wave and things change at once. That doesn't happen. Even when things change at once, they don't change at once. So things do grow and change. So I think that's an important message between how you change policy and how we change our own personal way of living and what we want to do. And that's an incredible story. I think it's an important story about how to do that. And not an easy one. Not an easy one. So, again, how you take these stories that we've just told, and if religion's about anything, it's about stories.
Right.
Lots of stories. And how you tell these stories, how do you use stories to change the conversation around us? Those kind of stories. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the stories about how difficult it is to make that change and how you should make that change. I mean, how do we use stories? How do you use stories? Do you use stories?
I definitely use stories.
You would use stories. Yes.
Yes. I use my own stories about my own health challenges and what we did to kind of reinvent our family. As I said, my husband is a survivor of cancer, and I was very, very ill at one time. And so we just dropped the bomb on our lifestyle. But it wasn't just the food piece, which I have to say, it's just not food. It's their whole lifestyle. Wellness is a lifestyle. So one of the things that we have, and we've all heard of something called inflammation, okay, that's a big thing now. Part of it is a sugar-related issue, and some of it is things like sleep deprivation and all kinds of things. We're not sleeping. We're not, you know, just not only are we not sleeping, the physical activity is still not where it should be based on the amount of calories that are being put in. And so there's a lot of things like that. So we tell the story of how we changed our life. And then I find other people in the congregation who have done similar things or who are working on it, and we just encourage them. And so having healthy meetups, so you take your child and you bring your child, and so they start, you kind of build your own network again of healthy eaters. And I've done several of those. We call it the Eat to Live Network. And so you bring someone, and then you expose them to it, and then they want to bring their mother. And I had one where in Atlanta we did it at a small public library, and it just blew up. They all started bringing their families and everyone. So we had to split it up and go to another little library. So we had these little silos all over, these libraries of people wanting to know how to eat healthier. But that is the thing. You can't necessarily stay within the environment that encourage you to eat bad. You kind of have to create another culture, another community, one at a time, of people who are definitely wanting to be a part of what you're doing.
So, you know, as we think about where this takes us, I'm really interested about how we think these kind of different ideas and stories that we tell and coming out of our different kind of congregation. Oh, go ahead. Before I go there, go ahead.
Yeah, so, I like the notion of stories. And stories are good because they're ways of educating people about what really is going on, but you do it in a way that is different. So we often tell the story, and you know the story, about the discrimination against white potatoes. Mm-hmm. There's a discrimination against white potatoes because the Institute of Medicine, when looking at the basket for WIC, Women, Infants, and Children's Program, said, you don't need to have white potatoes included in that in order to have a healthy diet. So they created a basket of all the necessary nutrients, and they did not include white potatoes. There are two parts to that story. So in Maryland, they actually did a study of WIC participants, and even though white potatoes weren't going to be included, you know, WIC participants eat white potatoes all the time. And what's the way they eat white potatoes?
Fries.
French fries. On a regular basis, they eat French fries and they eat white potatoes. But this is also a story about political power, because in the Congress, when it wasn't included, they didn't care about what science said, and they didn't care what the Institute of Medicine said. If you're from the state of Idaho or the state of Maine, you wanted white potatoes in the basket because you want to force women, infants, and children to eat white potatoes. Yep. And it's about forcing them to purchase those products on a regular basis. And so that's a battle that we're engaging in Congress as well. And they call it the discrimination against white potatoes, but that's not really what it's about. It's about the health of women, infants, and children.
Please.
I don't want to talk about white potatoes. I do want to cycle back to something that you talked about, which is that we're a bunch of silos. And so how do we go from silos to becoming spokes on a wheel? So we're able to reach out, we're able to touch the communities that you're talking about. And so maybe what we need to do is go back to another biblical principle, which is the concept of tithing. And perhaps all of the gardens initiatives that Hopkins funds obligatorily have to give 10% of their produce to a charity outside of their faith, so that that way we extend, because we can take care of our own, and that's okay, but that's just not enough. And then as we give out, maybe we can bring those people to our gardens to participate, to deal with the people labor that Abby was talking about. But also, as Monica was talking about, if you grow your own food, it tastes a lot better, doesn't it? Yeah. And not everybody has an opportunity to get involved. I mean, it's really cool when we see some of the kids. I mean, we have a cub reporter who writes about our garden all the time in our synagogue newsletter, but they're really proud of the garden. Kids really like it. And so if there's a way that we can tithe and establish a relationship of education and role modeling with outside of the congregations and bring them in for working on the garden, I think that would solve some of the chaos and craziness that are... Life is about silos. Life is about friction, and maybe we can work to grease the wheel a little bit.
I think that's a beautiful thought, and an important one. And I was thinking about, when you were saying that, and I was thinking about the garden here at Netivot Shalom, I was thinking about the other gardens I've seen. The one thing about growing gardens and sharing that idea, maybe sharing ideas together around gardens, is that's the one food set of food we can eat that everybody can eat. It can follow kosher laws, it can follow the Islamic laws, it can follow Seventh-day Adventists, whoever you are. We can all eat vegetables together without worrying about it breaking some law that in our traditions. So maybe that's a way to share gardens and share ideas and share recipes and ideas and bringing different groups of faith together around our gardens and motivating that also could affect public policy in the long run and in the short run. I mean, that's the kind of way, I think, of leaving our silos, because we're all going to go back to them, but leaving our silos to share what goes on. I'm going to go right over here. What did you want to say very quick, Michael? I'll go over here.
I was going to say, I was at the Howard County Food Bank today. And they purchase a lot of the food that they give away. They have their own garden, and they grow a lot of stuff, and they're real proud of that. But if you were going to tell them that you were going to donate fresh garden materials regularly, they could purchase less, and they would have more. So that's the kind of notion I think people would really rally to.
So I'm a full-time working mother of eight. A big part of raising kids that are health-minded is that getting them involved early on in the kitchen. My kids have rarely eat out. If they want pizza, for example, they make their own pizza. If they want Chinese, they make Chinese. And from a very young age, once you can hold a spoon, you're involved in some sort of kitchen process. And that's made a huge difference in their outlook towards food and planning a healthy meal. And they would never, ever consider making a meal without starting with a salad. And a dessert is a fruit and a choice of fruits. And yes, they on occasion will make sweets, but sweets are all homemade. They would never consider buying. And I think that's speaking to how to raise healthy families. That's a huge part of it. And the other point that I wanted to make is through Abby, I've gotten very involved try to get very involved in the garden, and I have found that to be a very humbling experience. And I think you go into this thinking that this is going to be an easy thing, and this speaks to Abby's comments about the need for manpower, but it's a very humbling experience, and I think that that's where a faith-based garden comes in, because if you're a more humble person, then you're more receptive to your faith and to being a better person through that. And I think that that's a big part of creating a better person and a better community, is humbling yourself to how much manpower is involved and how much work is involved.
That's really important, because I think that's hugely important. People don't understand what it takes to farm and grow things and bring them to the table, because we can just pick them off the shelf. And that's a very critical thing. And I'm glad this is good that we raised that. Go back here, and then we'll go over here. Then we'll bring Dariel to wrap it up.
Okay. Many years ago, I started working with kids in my community, providing healthy choices for them after school. I mean, many years ago. And then 4 years after that, I decided to take kids outside to start a garden. Well, those kids are 19, 20 years old right now, so they're no longer there. But I started growing food because I thought they should know where food came from. Well, a year later, I got a grant from Food and Faith. That was 6 years ago. And I wanted to invite my church to be a part of this project. And, you know, they thought, well, I got a grant. I can grow food and I can just give it to them, and they don't have to do anything. So I decided that I was going to grow the food and give it all away, and I was going to give it to the local food banks, not the food bank, but soup kitchens. We have soup kitchens and we have a couple of them in our community. So I was always just knocking at their door and just giving them stuff, and they was just very gracious. I even had nuns that was coming and get the food to take to their soup kitchen. A supper kitchen, that's what they were calling. And this year, after 6 years, one of the soup kitchens that I was providing food for has a garden in their back door.
Aww.
So that's progress, you know. Yes, so.
You were teaching.
Yes.
You were teaching along the way.
I guess I just want to say, and I appreciate these other stories, because the bottom line is we all underestimate the power of a human example. And just give a quick one from my wife and our experience. 22 years ago, we became vegan. And what we did was we invited the whole family over, like within a few months, and invited them to have a vegan dinner with us. And immediately after dinner, they all went to McDonald's. Okay. And her dad didn't come back for 2 years because he was afraid we'd starve him to death. But fast forward 20 years, and us just living this lifestyle in front of them, because we don't say much to them, living this lifestyle in front of them, we can go to any of her seven brothers and sisters, any of my three sisters' homes, and find, when we open their pantries, we can find things we can eat. Because, I mean, just our example has changed. The same with our garden. We have a garden in our church. And just having that garden in the neighborhood, it's 10 acres away from where the church is. But people from the neighborhood come over, they ask questions. The next thing you know, we've got people from the neighborhood now coming in, working. And in the church, people starting their own gardens just because of the human example. It's contagious.
So this is important. This is spiritual contagion. Our food is a good thing. So what I'd like to do here, and I think that just to say this, well, I'll say what I'm going to say at the very end. I'm going to let our panelists kind of have a kind of closing thought here, each one of them, and then I'll wrap this up and turn it over to Dariel, okay? Go ahead. So why don't you start, Sabrina?
Okay. I think in conclusion, and this has been a very good discussion, that we all can leave feeling a little bit more that we are a lot more in control of our food choices, our lifestyle, than we think. That we have to understand that in a faith-based community, we want to go countercultural when it comes to most of the lifestyle that we see on television and in everyday life and encounters, that we need to continue to do that. And as faith-based people, we do that anyway. We do that anyway in our value systems and our belief systems. So we just need to take that a little farther and look at it relative to, you know, our everyday, what we put in our bodies, and see our bodies as temples of God, and that this is an act of worship as to how we treat it. And then on the other hand, we want to understand that we are also charged with doing good, not doing harm, and so looking out for those who are less fortunate than us. And that also means being active in public policy or whatever. And if, in fact, that you have a congregation that you want to approach your leadership with a proposal as far as how to put healthy habits and how to teach or whatever, then I would say these seven disciplines could be used as a core curriculum in which to do that, so it could make it kind of easier to just drop in and make that happen.
Robbie Rawl. Mm-hmm.
The question was posed earlier, how best do we break down these silos and become spokes in the same wheel? You know, this is a movement, right? This is the beginning of the movement. And I would like to encourage you all to pledge to make these changes in your own homes and in your communities. And on a greater scale, on a state scale, to join the Sugar-Free Kids Coalition, We can assist your communities with the education and outreach efforts. By signing the resolution in front of you there, we can all bring our voice together and accomplish so much more and make changes on a grand scale.
Michael Wilson.
So I appreciate the opportunity to be here tonight and to join in this conversation. And I love all the small things people are doing in their own lives, in their own communities, in their gardens, changing your own diets. The one thing I would say is you should continue to do those things. But Mark and I talked about this. I believe in doing big things too. Mm-hmm. So the big things also need to be done, and they need your participation. And it is your responsibility to have these conversations in a broader way as well. So if you've never talked to your member of Congress about any of these issues, don't presume that someone else hasn't talked to them about in a different way. If you never talked to a state legislator or a mayor or anyone about this, don't presume someone else hasn't. And your voice is only going to be heard when you raise your voice. And I want you to continue to work on the things in your own lives. But this country, this state, this city is only going to be impacted by the other things that you do. So raise your voice for the big issues as well.
Abby Zuckerman.
And I think I
want to... Zuckerberg, I'm sorry.
That's okay. I think I want to say, first of all, that I'm honored that everyone was here. I think this was something new for our congregation, and it's really exciting for me. But I go back to, and no pun intended, the grassroots are probably the most important part of this whole process. If we communicate and we tell the stories and we inspire one another and we share and we reach out to one another and network, like I said earlier, I think that we can have much more of a voice in these realms. So thank you for being here, and let's hope we just keep moving from here.
And I want to say here in the conclusion before I turn the mic over is that we've had four of these so far, and we want to do more in the fall together and in the coming year. And I think that to figure out a way to gather all the people who have come to all these food and faith gatherings in some form together to bring everybody together. Some people have been to all four of them, are in this room. Some people have gone to a few of them. And some people are in their congregations more so up because we're at their congregation, not the next, but that's okay. But I think that the idea of kind of really continuing this as a major dialogue and conversation and keeping people together as we talk and get out of our silos and cross either the internet and these meetings is very critically important. And this has meant a lot to us being the Mark Steiner Show and my wife Valerie, who's here, who's helps run the program as well, and my producers, that it means a great deal to have this coalition and work with people. And I just want to say tonight, I want to thank the folks of Netivot Shalom. I found coming into your synagogue, to your shul tonight, for me, you can just feel it's a very open, warm, loving place. And it really feels good in here. Mm-hmm. And so I want to thank you all for letting us come in here and do this evening. The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are a production of the Center for Emerging Media, made possible in part by a grant from the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer at WEAA is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Public Radio Delmarva is Christopher Rank. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, and find out information from the interviews we are doing on this program, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download our podcasts on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and for WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM, Delmarva Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.